2 days. It had been 2 days since Alyssa stopped talking to her. 2 days of worry, torment, and loss. 2 days of her middle gnashing and her heart aching. 15 years ago, Alyssa walked out the front door of the house they shared with their parents and vanished like a puff of smoke on the wind. Now, it was happening all over again. And every moment that she didn't come back, a cold, steely fist gripped Marianne Preston's chest a little tighter, a little harder. She talked to herself in the hopes that Alyssa would answer, but she got no reply, save for the echo of her own voice. She prayed to God. This afternoon, she even sat at the kitchen table with a crude, homemade Ouija board. All to no avail. The first time around, Marianne was gutted. She and Alyssa were close. They shared a room. They told the other all their secrets. They giggled and painted each other's nails. They were one another's rock. This time, after finally having her back, she was devastated. She cried. She begged. She promised and bargained, but Alyssa wouldn't speak.
"I'm sorry, okay?"
she asked presently. She was in the cluttered living room, perched on the armchair facing the television set and hugging herself by nostalgic lamplight. The weatherman on a local NBC affiliate stood in front of a map of the region and listed tomorrow's temps. Marianne didn't like him. It was crazy, but she felt that he could see her through the screen, and that sly smile on her lips was at her expense. She was clad in a 3-day-old dress with sweat-yellowed underarms. Her blonde hair was messy, matted, and unwashed. She stared at a point above the TV with the distant eyes of a madwoman, and every so often she rubbed her long, spiny fingers up and down her arms as if to create warming friction.
"I won't talk to her, I promise. Just come back, please."
Her voice trembled, and she swallowed a sob before it could break free. The day before yesterday, she and Alyssa argued. Marianne wanted to meet Megan, and Alyssa told her no. Marianne didn't like that, and she told Alyssa she was going to do it no matter what she said. Then why shouldn't she?
"You know why,"
Alyssa had said. There was a cruel twist in her voice, and Marianne bristled.
"Because I'm crazy,"
she demanded, her voice rising.
"Because I'm a bad person, huh? Why can't I?"
"You know why."
"It was a mistake,"
she screamed, all of the dark emotions she kept locked in her heart breaking free like a black tide.
"I made a mistake,"
she broke down, crying.
"A mistake,"
she whispered.
"A mistake."
Alyssa hadn't spoken to her since, and Marianne could no longer feel her. Before, it was as though she were standing over her shoulder. Now, it was cold, empty, lonely. She drew a watery sigh and blotted her eyes with the heel of her palm. As much as people scared her, Marianne didn't like being alone. She never really had, but over the past several weeks, she had come to downright hate it. Having her so close by was like tasting the sweet air of freedom from a locked prison yard, knowing she was out there, close enough to hold and rock.
"I'm sorry,"
she'd say through her tears, and peppered her forehead with loving kisses.
"I'm so sorry."
Then they could be together. She could live here, and they could be normal. She'd even pick up the house and cook. She'd ignore the weatherman watching her and the neighbors plotting. She'd do anything.
"Anything,"
she mumbled.
"Anything to have you back."
A blade of remorse sliced through her stomach, and she rocked back and forth. "We're all human, and we do things we regret. Some of those things are minor, the kind that we think of and cringe just before falling asleep. And others are major. They eat away at us for years, like cancer, and we never quite get over them, even if we think we have." For her, this was one of the latter. She stuffed it deep in the darkest, most secluded corner of her heart and ignored it. She believed that she'd come to terms, but she hadn't. It was still there, still festering, covered by a scab so thin and membranous that one wrong move would tear it open. That one wrong move came, and all of that bitter poison backed into her system. A creaking floorboard brought her out of her reprieve, and her heart leapt. Alyssa. She got up and went to the head of the hall. It disappeared into a pit of darkness, black as ink.
Alyssa?
She asked, hopefully. She took a tentative step forward, then stopped to listen. Aside from the weatherman, the house was silent. Was she imagining things? Given how overwrought her nerves were lately, she very well could be.
Alyssa?
She asked again, her voice small and weak.
Is that you?
No reply. Letting out a disappointed breath, she turned, and someone grabbed her by the throat. Her heart jolted and her eyes widened, fingers clamping around the soft flesh of her neck. A blaze of shock dazzled her mind, then scattered when the intruder squeezed, cutting off her air supply. The world swam into focus, and Joey Vandermeer's face, clenched and flushed with frenzy, greeted her. His lips pulled back from his perfect teeth in a doggish sneer. Cold dread swept through her, and her knees went weak. 13 years ago, Joey Vandermeer hurt her, and 2 years before that, he hurt Alyssa. He was her boogeyman, her Satan, and terror paralyzed her.
You fucking bitch, he hissed.
He drove her back and slammed her into the credenza. Fire raged in his cold blue eyes, the same eyes that had haunted her dreams for over 10 years. The same eyes she feared meeting again if she left the house. Pressure swelled in her skull, and her lungs burst for air. Joey Vandermeer snarled down at her, and a memory struck her like a shot. Them making out in the back of his car on an out-of-the-way road. After Alyssa's disappearance, he came to her and offered his shoulder. She didn't know him, but he won her over with his kindness and sympathy. He said all the right things, held her when she needed him to, and understood her in a way that no one else ever had. She wasn't ready, though. Not for that. She pushed him away, but he didn't stop. He hit her, choked her, and took what he wanted. Something deep inside of her snapped, and coming alive, she raked her nails across his face, tearing 5 jagged red streaks into his flesh. She kicked and thrashed like an animal, backed into a corner, nearly breaking his grip. Flashing, he brought his fist down on her nose, and blinding white light exploded in her head, stunning her. He grabbed her neck with both hands and bore down. The edges of her consciousness turned warm and fuzzy, and her heart pounded. She was going to die. At the last minute, she summoned all the energy she had left and cried out for Alyssa. But Alyssa wasn't there. 15 years ago, Marianne failed to protect her. And now, today, she returns the favor. Part 19.
Help me.
Megan turned restively in her sleep, her face screwing up in an expression of consternation. Her head whipped from side to side, now, and her feet kicked at the bedclothes. Brody, stationed in front of the closet door, looked over his shoulder and whimpered, torn between comforting his master and protecting her from the light even now spilling from the seams around the door. If he moved, it might come out. He waffled a moment, then turned back. As much as he wanted to go to her, he had to be ready. If it did come out, he had to bite it and make it go away.
Please, I need your help.
Lost in a place of perpetual darkness, Megan stumbled, sightless, her hands feeling along slime-coated stone walls. Water dripped a steady tempo, and a stale draft caressed her sweaty face. The sickly, sweet stench of rotting meat found her nose, and somewhere in the darkness, something scraped on the floor. A footfall.
Help me,
Alyssa said, closer than before, her voice beseeching.
Please, Megan.
Somehow, Megan knew that Alyssa wanted something from her. Something big. Something awful. Something that she couldn't give. Something that would hurt her if she did.
I helped you,
Megan said, her voice turning into a sob.
I need more. I need you.
A hand fell upon Megan's shoulder, and every nerve ending in her body flared. Her feet tangled, and she fell to her knees. She felt her glasses slide off her nose and heard them clink to the ground. Warm, scummy water soaked through the fabric of her dress, and something wet, hot, and alive brushed her hand, and she wrenched it away with a cry. Hard hammering, she struggled to her feet and threw herself down the passage, hot breaths rasping from her chest.
We have to stop him, Megan. He killed my sister. He'll kill someone else, too.
Like flipping a switch, the dream changed. Now she stood in a tiny living room. Feeble lamplight revealed dirty walls, matted carpet, and things strewn across the floor. A man bent over a woman, half lying over a credenza, his hands fused to her throat, and her body twitching weakly. Megan's heart stopped, and she went rigid with fright. The woman let out a long gurgle, and the fight slowly left her, until she was limp. The killer held on for a long time, then let go, and stumbled back like a man waking from a trance. She toppled to one side and lay on the floor in a heap. Panting, the killer stared down at her, then knelt. As Megan watched in horror, he hiked her dress up, yanked her panties down, and reached into her shorts. The light winked out, and Megan was back in the dark.
Please, Megan,
Alyssa said.
We have to stop him.
Megan swallowed hard.
I don't want to,
she said. Alyssa materialized from the void, her face white, bruised, and dim like a wisp of smoke. She reached out one hand, a hurt look creeping into her eyes, and Megan sat up in bed with a gasp. Early morning sun, bright and vivid, suffused the room. Brody was curled in front of the closet door where he'd presumably fallen asleep, and Mr. Bob lay forgotten on the nightstand, looking at her upside down with a pitiful expression. Realizing it was only a dream, Megan took a deep breath and ran her jittering fingers through her damp hair. It had been nearly a week and a half since she found the box concealed in the wall. The dreams stopped, and she thought it was over. But 3 nights ago, they started again. In the first one, she was in the bathroom, staring into the mirror for some reason. After a moment, the glass rippled like the surface of a wind-dappled pond, and a decaying arm thrust out, tattered, mottled flesh hanging in strips from a skeletal frame. In the next, Alyssa's voice drifted from the closet.
Come here. I need you.
Megan knew instinctively that if she went in there, she would die. So she cowered under the blankets and begged her to go away.
Just leave me alone.
They were just dreams, she reminded herself. They couldn't hurt her, but the sense of danger in them lingered long after she was awake. And she could never fully relax. She once loved lounging in her room, her private domain after so long sharing with other people. But now she avoided being here alone as much as she could. She laid in the living room armchair, feet dangling over one arm and head resting against the other, and read or watched TV. And all the while, in the back of her mind, she dreaded going upstairs. Brody padded over and presented his head for a therapeutic pat, and Megan scratched behind his ears. She went back to the man and what he did, and she shuddered. Was that real? Or was Alyssa just trying to trick her into giving her what she wanted?
Was any of it real?
Alyssa was, but outside of that, Megan didn't know. Getting up, she dressed in a dark blue dress, then hurriedly brushed her hair. She'd been crampy and fatigued a lot lately. Her eyes lightly ached, and the corners of her brain were still foggy even as she sat down at the kitchen table. Tom sat across from her, eating a bagel, and Julia stood at the counter, spreading avocado on another.
Morning,
Tom said.
Morning,
Megan replied. Every morning for a week, Todd and Julia both asked her if she had any dreams the previous night. They were worried about the house being haunted or something. They never outright said, but their tension was palpable. Yesterday, she overheard them talking about having a paranormal investigator come out this afternoon. She didn't want to worry them further, so she didn't tell them she was having the dreams again. After all, they were only dreams. Julia brought Megan's bagel over and sat in front of her.
How are you feeling?
While Megan could hide the dreams, she couldn't hide the lethargy she'd been under since they started.
Okay,
Megan said. How'd you sleep?
Good,
she said. She quickly ate while Tom got up and helped Julia with the dishes. She was almost done when Julia said,
There's that Cody boy.
She glanced up at the clock on the wall.
Right on time.
An embarrassed blush touched Megan's cheeks, and she pretended not to hear. She and Cody had been walking to and from school together every day. Julia said he was cute, and Megan shrugged.
I guess,
she said, as though she hadn't noticed. She told them they were just friends, pleading her case with the impassioned zeal of a defense attorney whose entire career rested on getting her client off. But she had the nagging feeling that they didn't believe her. They were just friends, though. Even if he was kind of cute, and she did feel a little funny around him. Finishing her breakfast, she grabbed her backpack from the floor and slung it over her shoulder. She carried a plate over to the sink, wedged between her parents, and put it in.
Have a good day, honey,
Julia said, and kissed her forehead.
You too.
Tom kissed the top of her head, and then patted it. If he makes any sudden moves, go for the throat.
I will,
she promised. One, Cody wouldn't make any sudden moves. He was nice, no matter what the other kids said about him. And two, if he did, well, she probably wouldn't punch him. But there, that might really hurt him. She'd go for the guts. After saying goodbye to Brody, she went outside and through the back gate, then walked around to the front of the house. Cody stood by a fire hydrant looking around and metaphorically whistling to himself. The kids made fun of them even harder now, and she got the impression he was more embarrassed about it than she was. At lunch the other day, Taylor told her table they'd probably suck face in the porta-potty out back. That made her blush. Not because it shamed her, but because, well, thinking of kissing Cody made her feel like she had butterflies in her stomach. She wasn't lying when she told her parents she and Cody were just friends, but she wasn't being entirely honest. Yeah, he was her friend, but she liked him, too. He turned, saw her, and smiled tersely.
Hey.
Hey,
she said.
Sorry I'm late. I had kind of a rough night.
Another?
Yep,
she said, cutting him off.
Another dream. Yay me.
They'd been hanging out so much lately that they were finishing each other's sentences now. Okay, well, that wasn't really the reason. It was like, despite their differences, they were on the same wavelength or something. She told him about her dream as they walked the three blocks to school. When she reached the part about the woman, his face went white. Did she even have a sister?
I don't know,
Megan said.
I don't think the article we read mentioned one.
She thought back to the newspaper, but came up empty-handed.
We should double-check after school.
Okay, Cody said. Part of her hoped they didn't find it. Hoped that the terrible vision Alyssa showed her was fantasy. All of her feared that it wasn't. Tom and Julia were sitting at the kitchen table over coffee when a light, rapped, sounded at the back door.
That's probably him,
Tom said and stood. It was 10 to 1 in the afternoon of October 2nd, an hour later than the appointed time. Though she wouldn't admit it out loud, Julia was beginning to hope the investigator wouldn't show. That way they could put it off a little longer. What you don't know can't hurt you, and she was terrified of learning something injurious. Since moving into the house, she was happier than ever. then this came along, like a dark cloud casting a pall over a summer day. Now, finally, they were going to find out exactly what was happening. She carried a fragile flicker of hope in her breast. Megan hadn't had any dreams since she found the box, and neither she nor Tom had noticed anything out of the ordinary. She just wanted her family to be safe and happy. That's all. Tom went to the back door, unlocked it, and pulled it open. "Hi," he said. "Mr. Harriman," a soft, breathy voice asked. "That's me. Come in." He stepped aside, and the paranormal investigator crossed the threshold. Julia didn't know what to expect, but it certainly wasn't the short, pudgy man before her. Dressed in black slacks and a black blazer over a powder blue button-up, he stood roughly 5'5 to 5'6, if he was lucky. Greasy black bangs veiled his beady little eyes, and Julia was reminded of Shemp from the Three Stooges after Moe slapped him silly. Acne peppered his chubby face, and Julia counted three yellowish zits ready to burst. She and Tom had spent nearly a week looking up local paranormal researchers. In this part of the state, where the mountains are low and the hollers lower, there weren't many. The closest with any type of reputation was the Hart Agency out of Harrisonburg, and even then she doubted it was known outside of the region. "This is my wife, Julia," Tom said.
"Nice to meet you both. I'm Patrick R. You can call me Pat."
They sat at the table, Julia and Tom together, and Pat across from them. He produced a notepad from his coat, opened it, and flipped through, consulting notes he probably culled from his emails with Tom.
"All right," he said. "First of all, can you go through your story just one more time?"
He looked from Tom to Julia. Taking turns, they related the events of the last 2 weeks, beginning with Megan's dreams and ending with her recent lack thereof. Pat listened, nodding and making interested noises when appropriate, and jotted down everything. He asked questions here and there, but mostly scribbled like a writer in the throes of creative passion.
"Can you show me the closet?"
Julia swallowed. She hadn't been in Megan's room since that night, and the prospect of going in unnerved her. Even so, she and Tom led him up the stairs. He trailed behind, breathing heavily, and at the top, he paused for a second. At the door, Julia froze. Tom, sensing her trepidation, gave her shoulder an affectionate squeeze, then went in, closely followed by Pat.
"There,"
Tom said, and motioned to the closet. He didn't retreat, but he didn't approach, either. Pat opened the door and peered inside. "We patched the hole after the police said it was okay," Tom explained. "But you can see where it was."
"Do they know how long it was in there?"
"They said probably 10 years, at least."
"And you just moved in this past August, correct?"
"Yes." Pat reached into his coat and took out a small black device, roughly the size of a walkie-talkie. Arms crossed defensively, Julia leaned forward, her curiosity outweighing her fear.
"This is an EMF reader," Pat said. "It's used to detect spikes in electromagnetic energy, a.k.a. ghost energy."
He turned it on and static crackled. He went into the closet and held the EMF reader out in front of him, as if offering it to the spirits. "Prove to me you're here by taking this away from me. Can you do it?" He turned in a slow semicircle and glanced at the machine's readouts.
"Can I have both of you go downstairs, please?" he asked. "I won't be sure that your electro-emanations aren't interfering with the meter."
Tom and Julia exchanged a puzzled look. Electro-emanations? But did as they were asked. In the kitchen, he sat down, and she poured them each another cup of coffee.
"I hope he doesn't steal anything,"
Tom said.
"Except the ghost,"
Julia said in an attempt to lighten the mood. She came over and sat next to him.
"Well, he can have that," Tom allowed.
15 minutes later, Pat came back into the kitchen, and they both sat up straighter.
"Well, that's that," he said.
"Did you find anything?"
Julia asked. He hesitated, and her heartbeat quickened.
God, what was it?
A demon? A vampire? The Loch Ness Monster? The answer both surprised and relieved her.
"No, actually."
Sitting down, he produced his notepad and scanned it. Julia let out a deep breath and tilted her head back. Thank God. She didn't know how much she could trust parapsychology, but right now, she accepted his findings with gratitude.
I tried the EMF machine, the spirit box, and didn't get anything with either.
He held up a forestalling finger.
But that didn't mean that there's nothing here. Your daughter, can you tell me a little more about her?
Well, she's almost 13,
Julia started.
And very bright, very imaginative, but very mature.
We trust her on this, Tom said, picking up her thread. If she said it happened, it happened.
No, I believe something did happen,
Pat said.
But it might not involve a ghost, per se.
Julia furrowed her brow.
Then, what is it?
Taking a deep breath, Pat said.
I think it's more likely that what we see here is a sort of a psychic manifestation. You said you never experienced anything for yourself, right?
No,
Julia said.
But our dog acted very strangely around the closet.
Pat nodded.
Children and animals, too, are very perceptive. Their senses are, by default, a little sharper than yours and mine. Megan, I think, may possess some form of telekinetic power, meaning that she was able to sense the presence of the box and mentally glean what happened. Every living thing, you see, emits energy, and some people can pick up on that energy. Usually it presents in very minor and non-supernatural ways. Empaths, for example, can instinctively read people. With some, however, it's slightly more dramatic. That is where I believe most ghost sightings come from. Someone with more highly developed senses, who doesn't know that they have more highly developed senses, tuning in, as it were, to a frequency that the rest of us aren't privy to.
He sat back and donned a smug smile, obviously pleased with his own theorizing. Julia digested his words, and Tom cocked his head.
So, you're saying Megan's a psychic?
Not exactly, Pat said. Not in the Hollywood sense, anyway. Her brain is wired a little differently. She's more adept at reading energy. This girl who was put in the wall, she didn't get there herself. She was murdered. And something so traumatizing produces a lot of psychic and emotional energy. Think of it this way. Your dog can hear things that you can't. Like a dog whistle, for instance. His hearing is more attuned. That's Megan. I think that energy was rolling off the box in waves, like a stench. And Megan smelled it. Maybe I'm wrong here and something else is happening, but more often than not, the paranormal can be explained by extrasensory perception.
So, there is no ghost? Julia asked.
Likely no.
Is it safe for her to be here with that energy hanging around?
Absolutely, Pat assured her. I'd like to schedule an appointment to meet her and talk to her, if that's all right with you.
Sure, Julia said, and glanced at Tom, and he nodded. A Cheshire smile spread across Pat's lips.
Great.
After he was gone, Julia stuck out her bottom lip and blew a puff of air. Tom leaned against the counter and crossed his arms.
Looks like we don't have a ghost. Good,
Julia said and got to her feet.
I can deal with termites and property taxes, but not the undead.
Oh, now, hold on. I'd rather a ghost than termites. Ghosts don't need a house. She stepped into his arms and looked up into his blue eyes. He was several inches taller, and she had to push up on her tippy toes to kiss him.
But they do eat computer analysis experts.
He laughed and kissed her back.
Our psychic daughter will protect me.
Later on, Julia stood before an easel in her studio and mixed reds, blues, and greens on a palette. She was relieved, and for the first time in weeks, she felt good again. Things were looking up. Part 20. After school, Megan and Cody walked the 6 blocks to the library. It was a beautiful fall day with a light, cooling breeze from the west. Golden sunshine set the trees along the street ablaze in shades of orange and crimson. Cody walked slowly so that he didn't pull ahead of Megan. Even her purposeful stride wasn't enough to match him if he went at his normal pace.
"I like to walk," he said. "My mind just wanders, and that's nice." "Mine does that when I'm trying to sleep," she replied. "It bounces around, and sometimes I'm there for an hour, maybe more."
His did that occasionally. He'd cycle through thoughts like one of those flip picture books. Over the last week, however, only one thing had been on his mind. Megan. She ruled his every waking thought, and his dreams, too. Sitting in class and trying to focus on the assignment in front of him, he'd think instead of her eyes, her laugh, her cute, closed-lip smile, and her big, dazzling beam. He hadn't known her for all that long, but being apart from her had already become almost insufferable. When she wasn't around, he felt empty and yearned to be with her. The strength and persistence of these feelings scared him, but they also anguished him. His stomach constantly reeled, his mind dwelled on her, like worrying the same patch of flesh until it's raw and chafed, and pressure weighed down his chest every minute of every day. If he had to compare it to something, he'd say it was like being constipated. It was awful, yet somehow beautiful, too. He'd liked girls before, but this was different. He couldn't put his finger on it, but Megan just felt right. They clicked together like two puzzle pieces, and when he was with her, he felt generally better, stronger, smarter, and all of the other things in life. All of the bad things didn't matter. He never knew he was missing something until he met her. They weren't very much alike in their tastes. She liked reading long, involved walls of text masquerading as novels, and just thinking about it made his head ache. But they were alike in other ways. His home life wasn't so happy, and for the longest time, neither was hers. 2 days ago, sitting on a bench in Town Square with extra-large sodas from Tasty Freeze, he told her about his father. He didn't mean to, it just slipped out. Dad was pissed that morning because Cody drank the last of the orange juice and called him an inconsiderate faggot. Basically, the same thing Zeke always said. He was staring down at his feet and listening to Megan slurp her Coke when it hit him, and he blurted, "My dad's a bully." She looked at him, funny.
"What do you mean?"
And normally, he would have balked at even mentioning this to anyone, but he didn't now. He told her everything, and a sad frown touched her lips. When he was done, she rubbed a circle in his back.
"Your dad's a jerk."
That was such an understatement, it made him laugh. After a minute, she laughed, too. And it was all okay. Currently, they reached the library and went in. All but one of the computer terminals were empty, and a few old ladies circled the rows looking for something to read. In the basement, Megan loaded microfilm into the reader and turned it on. Cody looked around, found a chair, and dragged it over.
"All right," Megan said. "Let's see if we can find Alyssa's sister."
She checked every issue of the Democrats from April 2005 to March 2008. Cody sat forward to see the screen, hyper-aware of her closeness. His eyes darted between her legs and her hand resting on the table. Her fingers were slender and her skin translucent. The urge to lay his on top blossomed in his chest, but he beat it back.
"Got it,"
she said, bringing him back to reality. She adjusted her glasses and leaned in until her face was barely inches from the screen. "Missing girl's family marks 3 years since disappearance," said the headline.
"Marianne,"
Megan read.
"Is there... no. No address."
She sat back and scrunched her lips back and forth.
"That doesn't mean anything," he offered. She sighed. "Alyssa said the bad man killed her sister, and..."
She gestured at the screen. "Here it is. Proof positive."
"You didn't see him in your..."
She shook her head.
"Is there anyone in town?"
Cody thought.
"I don't think so. Marianne, Preston, I don't know. Sounds kind of familiar."
Later, as they walked home, Megan said,
"We should probably call the police, just to be sure."
And told him what? Cody asked. That he had a dream about someone named Marianne Preston? Megan opened her mouth, then closed it again.
Well, I did that when I found the box.
That was true. Still, something about it didn't sit well with him. If you want, I guess.
I kinda do,
she said. At Megan's house, he sighed, because, yet again, their time together had come to an end. Text me if you do.
Okay,
she said. He hesitated for a moment.
Good night. See ya.
He waited until she went through the door, then he turned and started home. Could he keep doing this? Every day it got just a little harder to hide how he felt. And before long, he'd take her hand and hold it no matter how hard he fought it. Maybe he should tell her. A shot of dread soured his stomach. Even if she rejected him, she wouldn't stop being his friend. She wasn't like that. She was nice. He had nothing to lose, really. And everything to gain. His stomach fluttered, and he decided. Tomorrow. He'd tell her he liked her tomorrow. It was dusk by the time he reached his house. A light shone in the kitchen window, and he stopped. A cop car sat in the driveway. Oh, no. What did Dad do? Every so often, the neighbors heard Dad yelling and tearing down the house and called the police on him. Mom did a few times, too, after he hit her. But she hadn't in a long time. The house, never inviting, took on a threatening cast, like a coiled viper ready to strike. And a voice deep in the back of Cody's head told him to turn around. But he couldn't. He had to meet it head on. If he left and came back hours later, he wouldn't know what he was walking into, and he might be a sitting duck. For what, he didn't know. For something. Sighing, he crossed the driveway, climbed the back steps, and went inside. TV sounds drifted from the living room, and the smell of coffee seasoned the air. Mom sat at the table with Sheriff Harper, whose titanic bulk spilled over either side of his chair. Mom's face was strained and paled, as though she were fighting to keep herself from breaking down. And Cody felt nothing for her. He'd seen that face too many times before to feel anything anymore. They looked up when he came in and he swallowed.
What's going on?
Mom started to talk, but Sheriff Harper cut him off.
Your dad didn't come home today, and your mom's worried about him.
Cody looks to his mother for confirmation, and she nodded.
It's probably nothing. I just...
She trailed off.
Can you go to your room, please?
That question struck him as odd, but he obeyed. At his door, however, his curiosity got the better of him. He opened and closed it so they would think he went in, then crept to the archway, back against the wall.
Like I was saying,
Sheriff Harper said,
knowing him, he could have just run off.
Cody's chest stirred. Dad ran off.
He wouldn't do that,
Mom argued. The chair creaked as, presumably, Sheriff Harper shifted his weight.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he wouldn't. I can't say. It doesn't seem too shocking that he would. You called all the hospitals and the state police and nothing, right?
No. And the plant said he didn't come in this afternoon.
It looks like he could have taken off on his own. Me and my boys can keep an eye out, but there's not much we can do till you file a missing persons. And you can only do that after 2 days.
Mom sighed.
Just hang in there. He could have gotten home with someone, gotten drunk or something. Give it another day, and if he doesn't come back, we can file that report.
In his room, Cody sat on the edge of his bed. His father was missing. Like Sheriff Harper said, he was probably drunk somewhere. He'd come through the door at midnight, reeking of booze, and start a fight with Mom. It wouldn't be the first time that happened. Cody hoped he didn't, though. He hoped his father never came back. After leaving Andy Miller's house, Bill Harper drove back to the station by way of Magnolia Street. The melting sun colored the western sky boiling scarlet, and cool purple shadows filled the world like rising waters. He was almost into town proper when the CB crackled.
I just tried at the Preston house, and nothing.
Those hearts sank. Preston.
All right.
Terry came back.
I'll radio Sheriff Harper in a bit. He's busy.
Bill snatched the headset up and depressed the talk button.
I'm here. What's up?
Static hissed and acid chugged in Bill's depths.
That Megan Harriman girl called up a while ago and said she had a dream someone killed Marianne, wanted us to check on her.
As soon as he heard that name, Megan Harriman, Bill's stomach dropped out.
I'll be right there.
Replacing the headset back in its cradle, Bill curled his fingers around the steering wheel and resisted the urge to turn on the lights and slam the pedal to the floor. Megan Harriman, the girl who somehow knew what happened to Alyssa Preston, the girl who Joy believed was getting intel from someone. Who, he didn't know. But as he pulled onto Marianne's street, he could hazard a guess. Christ, this was bad. Cold fear settled over Bill like a funeral shroud. Did she know who did it? Did she know he was involved? Joey said no one did. That anything she or her source said would be simple hearsay, and people wouldn't believe them over the sheriff and a respected, prominent citizen. Maybe he was right, but Bill knew damn well that once scrutiny fell on them, the state police would zero in. And if a bunch of determined cops set out to find something, they're going to find it. No ifs, ands, or buts. Joey's words came back to him. I'll deal with it. Stay out of my way. Bill sure fucking hoped so. Chuck's cruiser was parked under a streetlight in front of Marianne's house. He stood by the back end and nodded when Bill pulled up behind him. Full dark had fallen, and the houses up and down the way twinkled like stars in the sky. Bill glanced uneasily at the darkened facade of Marianne's bungalow and climbed out. He wasn't a drinker, but after the past couple weeks, he could use a couple stiff ones. And a vacation. Daytona Beach sounded nice.
I knocked, but no one's answering,
Chuck said when Bill walked up.
Looks like no one's home,
Bill said. Like a haunted house, every small town has its resident weirdo. Marianne Preston was Rossville's. Bipolar, depressive, and possibly schizophrenic, Marianne had always been off. But she got worse a few years after her sister died. She stumbled home one night, half naked and covered in dirt and bruises, and told her mother someone raped her. She wouldn't say who, though, probably out of fear. She spent a few months in the nut house in Stanton after a botched suicide attempt, and these days rarely left her house. People said they saw her walking around at night like a ghost, and outlandish rumors cropped up about her the same way they did Cody Miller.
Maybe we missed her, he added.
I don't know, he said. She's always there. Bill sighed.
All right, come on.
Taking out his flashlight, he went up to the walk and ascended the stairs. A wind chime tinkled in the darkness, and a potted plant on a fanciful iron shelf rustled in the breeze. Bill opened the storm door and knocked. After a minute, he went to the window, clicked on the flashlight, and shone it against the glass. The curtains were parted just enough for him to see in. That wasn't suspicious for someone like Marianne. He swept the beam back and forth and stopped when it fell on something jutting from behind the couch. A bare, pale, white foot. Bill's heart jagged.
I see her,
he said, and snapped the light off. He moved with a marked lack of urgency. If she wasn't dead, he wanted to give her as much time to get that way as possible.
Break down the door.
Chuck gave a jerky nod and went to the door. Taking the knob in his hand, he rammed his shoulder into it until it popped open with the crack of breaking wood. No sooner was it open than the unmistakable stench of decay hit Bill like a fist. He whipped his head away and swallowed his gourd.
Thank God, he thought. Oh, thank God.
Later, the medical examiner put Marianne into a body bag and shoved her into the back of his van. Neighbors in bathrobes stood in their yards and on their porches, gawking, and yellow crime scene tape snapped in the wind, making a crisp sound. Bill watched the van pull off, and only then did it occur to him to wonder just how in the hell Megan Harriman got mixed up with Mary Ann Preston. That question nagged him for the rest of the night, and before he dropped off, he decided he was going to find out. Part 21.
Help me,
the voice said, echoing through the chambers of the haunted house. Cold wind moaned in the leaves, and rats thumped in the walls like ghostly knocks. The walls rotted, bare boards showing through tatters of decomposing wallpaper and gaping holes dotted in the ceiling, admitting improbable moonlight. Vines, trees, and weeds crept between cracks in the living room floor, and shivering drafts swept in through broken windows, chilling Megan's skin. The earthy odor of decay pinched her nose, and the teeming sounds of 1,000 bugs, burrowing mammals, and ghosts found her ears. She knew where she was, but she didn't know. Recognized this place, but could not name it. It looked like the group home, only completely different. The linoleum floor in the kitchen popped beneath her feet, and a cabinet door above the sink opened and closed on its own. Just the wind. Green eyes watched from the shadowy corners, and cobwebs broke across her face when she crossed into the dining hall. But she felt no fear. A table, elaborately set, stood before her. The candles unlit, dishes empty. White curtains whispered in the breeze, and the chattering of mice served as a call for every unseen thing to come and feast.
Megan.
A steep, narrow set of steps led to the second floor. Several treads missing, and the handrail split in places. She was in the house on Chestnut Street now, only it wasn't exactly the same. The windows that faced the head of the stairs in real life were gone, replaced by a heavy oaken door. Everything around it was gray, coated in dust and decomposing, but it was spared, the wood polished, gleaming. She stopped and looked up at it. For the first time, apprehension twinged in her chest, and a tremble raced through her. Something terrible lay on the other side of that door, and if she opened it, she would die.
Please help me.
Megan's hand went to the knob, and her mind screamed for her to stop. She tried to pull back, but she was already turning it, already stepping through. Now she stood in the threshold of a tiny room boasting a bed, a desk, and a chair. Moonbeams bled through slats of wood covering the window, and the frosty air nipped at her exposed skin. She hugged herself, breath misting before her, and rubbed her arms for warmth. A flash of movement on the other side of the bed caught her eye, and she froze. A hand, white and streaked with dirt, clawed up from behind, gripping the sheets. Next, a face appeared, rising over the mattress like the craggy moon over blasted hell. Yawning pools of shadows where its eyes should have been. Mottled gray flesh, jagged yellow teeth cramming a too big mouth. It pulled itself onto the bed, and Megan's heart stopped. She stood there, stock still, as it slithered over the comforter and onto the floor, less than 10 feet away now, its dead stench preceding it like a deadly omen. It reared up on its hands and knees and threw its head back with the wet, sickening snaps of breaking bones. Dark, scraggly hair framed its cemetery visage, and its skin hung in strips from its skull, much like the wallpaper downstairs. Megan's soul shrank, but she herself did not move. She was rooted in place, unable to heed her brain's frenzied pleas to turn and run, unable to think, unable to even breathe. The thing scuttled forward on long, spindly limbs like an overgrown crab.
Help me.
Megan squeezed her eyes shut, But as in all the other dreams, she could still see every horrible detail. The thing was on its stomach now, dragging itself, nails digging into the floorboards, and a greasy black blood trail marking its wake. It was 3 feet away, close enough to reach out and grab her, and Megan was trapped, held in place, heart blasting, head throbbing, lungs heavy. Tears spilled down her cheek, and when the thing closed its icy hand around her ankle, a high, throat-ripping scream tore from her throat, and she sat up in bed with a gasp. Brody stood in front of the closet door, and in that disorienting moment between sleep and awake, Megan swore she saw a glimmer of light beneath the door. Something screeched next to her, and she jumped. The alarm clock. She slapped the off button and regulated her breathing. The voice reverberated in her head, so clear it was almost like it had actually spoken.
"Help me."
She swallowed hard and hugged herself, realizing she was shaking. Brody came over and looked up at her. "Are you okay, Master?"
"I don't know,"
Megan said. On Thursday evening, she called the sheriff's office and told them about the dream where Alyssa's sister was murdered. They sent someone to her house and found her body in the living room. The paper said she was sexually assaulted and strangled about a week before she was discovered. Afterwards, Sheriff Harper came out and talked to her, while Tom and Julia sat, grim-faced, at the table. She didn't want them to know about the dreams, but this was kind of important. Someone got murdered, and the killer was still out there, probably waiting to kill again.
"All right, Ellie,"
Sheriff Harper said.
"Tell me exactly what you saw."
Steeling herself for the memory, she recounted the nightmare from start to finish, and the blood slowly drained out of his face, which told her Marianne Preston's death played out in real life, exactly as if it had in her dream.
"Is that how it happened?"
Julia asked. Her eyes were wide with horror as she hugged herself tightly. Sheriff Harper nodded.
"As far as we can tell."
After he left, Tom and Julia sat her down and told her about Pat, the paranormal researcher. Megan instantly dubbed him Paranormal Pat. They wanted him to come out as soon as possible and meet her, and set an appointment for later that week.
"He thinks this is all psychic," Julia said,
the words coming hard.
"Has anything like this ever happened before?"
Tom asked curiously.
"Dreams that come true. No one thinks,"
Megan thought really hard.
"Well, sometimes I'll think about a song or a certain episode of a TV show, and it'll come on."
"That's all?" She went back over her entire history with a fine-tooth comb, scouring for anything out of the ordinary. There were small things, like finishing people's sentences the way she did with Cody, and one time, at the group home, she somehow knew she was going to be blamed for something. 10 minutes later, out of the blue, one of the other girls came into her room and accused her of not flushing the toilet in the communal bathroom. Those didn't really seem important enough to warrant the term psychic. They were coincidences or something, right? She thought of Cody and how being with him felt right, as though they were two halves of a whole. She thought of them as being on the same wavelength, and sometimes she got, like, feelings about him and knew what he was thinking. Not like word for word, but the general gist. Was she a psychic? Brody whined, and Megan looked at him. "Why don't you know if you're okay or not?"
"Because she wants something,"
she said to Alyssa. What something was, she didn't know, but she was starting to guess in a roundabout way, and it scared her. If Tom and Julia were right, though, she was only, like, reading thermal energy or something. Tom said Pat likened it to a dog hearing a whistle. It's like having a good nose so you can smell things that other people can't.
"They're pictures,"
Julia said.
"They can't hurt you."
Megan wasn't so sure about that. But if so, what did Alyssa really want from her? Were her dreams a metaphor? Did Alyssa want to use her powers to bring her killer to justice? Or did she want to use her powers, her essence, her very lifeblood, That latter is what Megan assumed. The ghost wanted to suck up all her life so that she could come back. But maybe she was wrong. Either way, she didn't want to find out.
I don't know,
she admitted to Brody. Getting up, she got ready for the day. At least she had one good thing to look forward to. Seeing Cody. Cody woke on the morning of Monday, October 5th, from a thinned and fitful slumber. Rain dribbled down the window pane, and the clock on the nightstand flashed 3:13 a.m. The power must have been knocked out, though in his murky state, he couldn't figure out why. Rolling onto his side, he grabbed his track phone and checked the time. 6:04. Digging his elbows into the mattress, he drew himself to a sitting position and rubbed the sleep from his eyes. The house was silent, and he instinctively listened for the sound of his father's footsteps, but didn't hear them. Dad had been gone since Friday, and it was starting to look like he wasn't coming back. On Saturday, they found his car abandoned in a stand of trees along I-81, but not him, for which Cody was thankful. For as long as he could remember, Dad hated him. Mom said again and again that he didn't. Mom said again and again that he didn't. That's just how he is, honey. Well, yeah, hating him was how Dad was. He never understood it. He tried so hard to make Dad happy, but he was never pleased. Then, yesterday afternoon, he found out why. It was just after 4, and he came out of his room to get a drink of water. The last he knew, Mom went to the grocery store to grab a few things. But when he walked into the kitchen, he found her sitting at the table with a cup of coffee in front of her. His eyes went to the pill bottle next to it, and he knew at once that she was high. She looked up at him, her gaze hazy and unfocused, and gave a wan smile. Dad treated her like shit, smacked her, called her names, pushed her around, but she was taking him leaving really hard. That morning, he heard the sound of soft sobbing coming from her room, and every time he crossed paths with her, she seemed lost, like a mother hen whose nest was suddenly and inexplicably empty.
Hi,
she slurred.
Hey,
he replied awkwardly. He hardly ever talked to her except for in passing. He couldn't bring himself to say he hated her, but he couldn't bring himself to say he loved her either. Through it all, the taunts, beatings, and paychecks pissed away on natty ice, she stayed with Dad and let him do whatever he wanted. She complained and fought him here and there, but if she really cared, she would have left him a long, long time ago.
Come here,
she said.
We need to talk.
Cody didn't want to talk to her, especially not when she was doped up and looking like she was going to nod out at any moment. He sat across from her anyway. She lifted the mug to her lips and took a sip. It shook in her grasp, and some of the contents sloshed over the rim. She sat it down with a clunk and blinked, as if fighting against going to sleep.
How you doing?
She asked. Okay, Cody said neutrally. He really wished he stayed in his room. Mom ran her fingers through her messy hair.
That's good.
She looked like she wanted to say something more, then took another drink, perhaps to buy herself some time. She sat it down again and looked at the table. She took a deep breath, and when she spoke again, Cody thought he misheard her.
Andy's not your father.
It took those words a moment to sink in. What? She nodded.
Andy's not your father.
Bewilderment gripped him. Wait. Dad wasn't his dad? What do you mean, he's not? Mom sighed.
Your father is someone else.
She trailed off, and a pained expression flickered across her face, as though what she intended to say hurt too much to relate.
It's someone else. That's all.
Who? He asked. She told him, and his jaw hit his chest. His mind went haywire, and for a moment, he just gaped, too taken aback to formulate words or even a coherent thought.
Seriously?
Mom nodded.
Yes.
The mist in her eyes seemed to clear, and she fixed him with a stern gaze.
Don't say anything to anyone, especially not him.
She spat the word like it was foul. Her vehemence caught him off guard.
Why?
Because... just don't, okay?
She reached across the table and clamped his hand. That, more than anything else, communicated the severity of her admonishment.
Okay.
In his room, he flopped back onto the bed and stared up at the ceiling. Outside, he was calm, placid even. But inside, he was a raging tempest of emotions, and his mind raced as he processed his mother's revelation. He hated his father, or the man that he thought was his father. But what Mom told him hurt anyway. No wonder Dad was like this. He thought of every time he tried to hug him or ask him to play or anything, and he felt like a fool. Not your father. But how did Mom and his real dad happen? Their coupling didn't make any sense to him. They were as unlike as night and day, and he just couldn't picture them together. And why did Mom say not to tell anyone? A conflagration of confusion and curiosity engulfed him, and he lay awake long into the night, digesting the news. Sitting here now, he thought of his father, his real father. What was he like? Would he be happy if he went to him, or would he turn him away? Mom didn't want him to talk to him, but that's probably because they fought or something. A feeble spark of hope ignited in his chest, and he wondered. Mom looked really serious when she made him promise not to tell. He probably shouldn't. Still mulling it over, he got up, showered, and dressed. He and Mom went to the laundromat on Saturday afternoon, so he was able to dress in clean clothes for the first time in a week. That was important now more than ever, because he didn't want to smell funny around Megan. His stomach knotted at the thought of the sweet, ponytailed girl he loved. Yes, loved. He wasn't certain what love felt like, but it was the only word strong enough to describe what he felt for her. It sure wasn't like. You like a friend or even a crush. Megan was neither of those things. She was more. He'd been meaning to tell her his feelings for days, but he always chickened out at the last minute. Today, he told himself, as he had for almost a week, he would do it today. Monday afternoon, Bill Harper drove out to the state police impound lot off I-81. A sea of repossessed cars, trucks, boats, and even a helicopter. It occupied 10 acres of wooded ground 5 exits down from the first off-ramp to Harrisonburg, and even in the middle of the day, there was too much traffic. Andy Miller's used 2003 Chevy Malibu sat in a garage attached to the building, its 4 doors standing open, and a crime scene investigator in gloves, white coveralls, and a respirator going methodically through it for evidence. Captain Gary Fordham, whom Bill had known for years, came in from the office and stood next to him, feet far apart and arms crossed sternly over his bulky chest. A tall, balding man with a weather-beaten face like cracked leather, Fordham reminded Bill of Clint Eastwood in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, except less handsome.
Found anything? Bill asked.
Not yet,
Gary said.
I don't know if you will,
Bill said.
I've known Andy my whole life, and I don't know, this feels like him running out.
The tech emerged from the back seat and climbed in behind the wheel, kneeling to lean over the center console.
You think?
Gary asked. Bill pursed his lips. Andy Miller had been an alcoholic since he was 16 years old. He'd been arrested 12 times on DUIs and domestic violence charges, and his wife admitted that every so often he wouldn't come home exactly when he was supposed to.
He sounded to Bill like the kind of self-centered man who'd decided to cut out one day. Then, the box. In all likelihood, he said. He's a drunk, a woman beater, poor as dirt, prime candidate for getting fed up and leaving. Gary shifted his weight from one foot to the other.
Sounds like it. He have any enemies?
Why did Bill feel put on the spot? None that I know of, he said. Not many people really liked him well, but no one outright hated him. Except maybe his kid. He has good reason, if you ask me.
How old?
Gary asked. Bill thought for a moment. 13. In his periphery, Gary deflated a little. He was hoping for a suspect. If foul play is involved, the kid didn't do it.
Unless his mom's the one who did it.
Gary pointed out.
She could have had help. You said Andy beats her, right?
She didn't do it either, Bill said. Either she's broken all up, or she's the best goddamn actress this side of Hollywood. Greg sighed.
Why would he dump his own car?
There was a note of bafflement in his voice. Now, that I don't know, Bill said. Maybe he had someone pick him up. A girlfriend no one knew about.
Maybe.
Gary allowed. An hour later, after the tech wrapped up with no new evidence, Bill climbed back into his squad car for the return trip to Rossville. The rain had let up, but the leaden sky promised to open up any minute. On the interstate, big rigs on their way to distant ports kicked up sheets of dirty, gray water and rocked the car with the wind displaced by their passage. Even on wet days, such as this, long-haul types had to bust ass to get their loads where they're going. Bill's uncle, Charlie, was a trucker, which gave Bill a deeper understanding of them than most. Poor Charlie used to stay awake for days at a time just to make his deadlines. It was either that or lose his job. Parking the lot facing Town Square, Bill killed the engine and got out. Inside the station, Terry sat at her computer with a phone wedged between her shoulder and the side of her head. Bill paused at the counter and waited. When she hung up, he asked,
"Who was that?"
"Kiki Allen, down at the middle school,"
Terry said. Deidre Allen was the head secretary and resident Hitler of Rossville Middle's front office, much like Terry was here.
What did she want?
It wasn't rare for her to call over a fight or something, or if she or Frank thought a kid needed to be scared straight by a visit from the sheriff.
"Frank Stone didn't come into work today,"
Bill sputtered.
He didn't?
"Nope,"
Terry said.
"He didn't call, either. She says that's not like him and wants someone to check on him. I told her that's probably not going to happen unless he doesn't come in tomorrow, either."
Bill sighed.
"Everyone's on edge on account of Andy Miller and what happened to Marianne."
"Andy probably took off on his own," Bill said. "Marianne, he knew damn well what happens to Marianne and who did it to her."
So far, the crime lab hadn't found any physical evidence, but Bill didn't think they would. He hadn't talked to Joey about it, but he was certain the Playboy covered his tracks. There was the matter of the sexual assaults, which shook Bill greatly. Killing her to keep her quiet was one thing, but doing that... He couldn't say he was surprised, though. Not really. "Maybe I'll drive out by his house later on," he said. Maybe it was a coincidence, but Andy and Frank both going missing, two men tied to what happened all those years ago. Leaning over, Terry picked up a folder.
"Before you do that, you got this on the fax machine, those files you wanted."
"Oh, that was quick." Bill took it and paged through to make sure it was what he wanted. It was.
"Alrighty then, I'll swing by Frank's later."
Taking the folder into his office, he sat behind the desk, the chair creaking under his weight. He opened it and took out the first sheet. The state seal of West Virginia occupied the upper left corner, and beneath that, in bold black, were the words, "Certificate of Adoption." Bill leaned back and scanned it. Before being adopted by Tom and Julia Harriman, Megan's surname was Wilson, and she lived in a girls' group home in Maxwellton, West Virginia, under the supervision of Davis Stewart, Inc., a non-profit organization housing children in state custody. Her records indicated that she was brought to a fire station in Bluefield by a pastor, Wilson, for whom she was named. He found her on the doorstep of his church, swaddled in a heavy wool blanket and placed in a cardboard box, quote, like an abandoned kitten. She was approximately 8 days old and showed signs of being well cared for. As Bill read, a memory began to form in the back of his mind, vague and faint at first, then growing as it bubbled to the surface. A slight frown played across his lips, and he looked up from the page. Blinds half covered the glass partition wall, providing an unobstructed view into the squad room. Terry came out of the break room with a mug of coffee, and Chuck reclined against the front counter, arms bent on the edge and facing the door. Was he misremembering? Was... No, that'd be too neat, too perfect, too coincidental. But what if? He sighed deeply. Megan Harriman was really starting to get under his skin. Right now, he could readily accept that Marianne told her about Alyssa, but how did she know what happens to Marianne? He'd been telling himself she was lying, that she went over to the woman's house, found her dead, and called in under the guise of asking about her to keep a degree of separation between them. She had to be lying. Joey Vandermeer did it. He'd bet his bottom dollar, and she didn't describe him. She just said it was a man. How did she know about the sexual assault? Simple. Marianne's panties were off and her dress hiked up to her hips. Megan somehow gained access to the house, saw, and just assumed. Nothing more, nothing less. It was all becoming clearer to him now. Megan Harriman was trouble. But without Marianne, without hard evidence, she couldn't do a damn thing. Could she? He didn't know, and that scared the shit out of him. There could be proof of his involvement out there, a shred of something he knew nothing about, fabric or DNA or a single fucking hair. A tight band closed around his chest, and the walls seemed a little closer, the air a little hotter. Taking a deep breath, he returned the paper to the folder and closed it. Maybe he'd go out to Frank's, and if he wasn't home, he'd call Joey Vandermeer, just to make sure. Part 22. At the end of the day, Cody shoved his books into his locker and ducked into the bathroom. Gripping the sink top, he stared at himself in the water-splotched mirror. His face was ashen and drawn, and moist worry pooled in his eyes. His lips carved across his sallow flesh in a bloodless slash, and he looked like he was going to be sick. In all fairness, he felt like he was going to be sick. Nerves racked his stomach, and cold sweat lightly coated his palms. His knees shook, and if he loosened his hold on the counter, his hands would too. Today, he was going to tell Megan that he liked her. He was twisted in knots and worried she'd reject him, but he had to do it. He pushed away from the sink and went out into the hall. But most of the others had gone, and only a few stragglers remained. Outside, Megan stood next to the flagpole with her books pressed to her chest, and when Cody saw her, his heart blasted. Every afternoon, like a loyal dog, she waited for him. He always halfway expected her to one day not be there, to leave him just as everyone had. But she didn't. That's what he liked about her most. Not her beauty, but her personality. She was nice and fun and all that other stuff, and she made him feel whole. She could be fat and ugly and blind, and he would love her just the same. He went down the stairs and walked over, and Megan flashed a big, heart-stopping smile.
Hey,
she said.
Hey,
he replied. Ready?
Yep.
They crossed the lawn separating the school from the streets and picked up the sidewalk. Sunshine leaked through the cracks in the clouds and glistened on the slick pavement. A man in a charcoal gray sweater raked his front lawn. Wasn't it too wet for that? And a little girl rode a pink tricycle in circles, bundled in knee pads, elbow pads, wrist pads, and a helmet like a fragile vase packed in bubble wrap. At West Street, they turned right and walked 3 blocks to the northeast corner of the park. As they did, Megan sighed.
So in my dreams,
she started,
I have the feeling like Alyssa wants to use me to get at the man who killed her and her sister.
She'd said that before.
Like she needs to use my energy, and if she does, it might hurt me.
Cody furrowed his brow. What do you mean, use your energy? A trail opened up in front of them, its edges lined by towering pines through which errant shafts of sunlight fell.
I don't know. It's weird,
she said.
I think it's a metaphor, though.
From what?
She wants me to use my time and energy to bring the killer to justice.
She spoke with a conviction that left no room for doubt. You don't know who the killer is, though. She hung her head.
I know. She hasn't shown me yet, and I don't think she can. How are you going to find him?
The forest fell away, and a wide, grassy plain stretched away toward a chain-link fence enclosing a basketball court.
I don't know, Megan sighed. I wouldn't even know where to start unless she gives me more clues.
A bench set away from the court faced a garden of lilies surrounded by fanciful blocks. The past couple days, he and Megan came here to talk and hang out. Today, the seat was speckled with beads of water. Megan came to a halt.
Oh, it looks like we can't use our bench.
Yes, we can, Cody said. He unzipped his hoodie, shrugged out of it, and laid it on. There, he said, and gestured to it. She chuckled.
Now your shirt's wet.
Cody shrugged. Oh well. A fond smile spread across her lips, and turning, she sat with a flourish.
There's enough room for you, too,
she said, and patted the spot next to her. Yeah, barely. He'd basically have to sit in her lap. A prospect that wasn't so bad, really. He hesitated, then sat, his leg pressed against hers, and an inch or so of his butt touched the bench, water soaking through the fabric of his jeans. Megan pressed her knees together to give him more space, and he did the same. For a while, they watched a group of teens playing on the court. Cody's mind drifted to what he was planning, and Megan, like the psychic her parents thought she was, picked up on it.
What's up?
She said.
You've been really deep in thought today.
I found something out this weekend, he said. Half turning to face him, Megan asked.
What?
Well, you know how my dad's missing, right? She nodded. He told her all about his father and how glad he was he left. He thought she'd think he was awful, but she understood.
It turns out he's not really my dad.
Megan blinked in surprise.
Oh, he's not?
Cody shook his head. No, it's someone else, and that's why he never liked me. She darted her eyes uncomfortably to her lap.
I'm sorry. Did your mom...
No, Cody lied. She didn't say who it is. A sardonic smile ran across his face. It's funny. He hated my guts, and I hate his, but it's kind of... He didn't process the powers of articulation to convey the crazy tangle of emotions inside of him, or to describe the profound surreality of discovering that your entire life was a lie.
I don't know, he said, finally. It's a lot to take in. I bet,
she said.
At least I knew up front that I didn't have parents.
He nodded, more to himself.
I just wish me and Dad got along more, and he didn't hate me.
Megan wavered, then laid her hand on his, the soft kiss of her skin sending his heart into his throat. He looked up at her, and she offered a diffident smile.
That's his loss, because you're pretty great.
You're great too, he stammered. Their eyes locked, and something seemed to pass between them. He weaved his fingers through her, and a lovely pink blush crept across the bridge of her nose. Cody's heartbeat sped up, and the head-spinning sensation of falling came over him. As one, gazing into each other's eyes, they leaned tentatively in, their heads tilting. Time slowed down, their noses brushed, and their excited breaths mingled. Then, with an electric shock, their lips grazed. For a second, neither made a move to follow through, teetering on the brink of something from which they could never return. The sweet taste of her breath filled his nose, intoxicating his senses, and the downy touch of her lips stirred him as nothing ever had before. Gingerly, Cody swirled his tongue around hers, and her body went rigid, her exhalations coming faster. Panting, her fingers curling into his hand as if clutching for purchase. After a long, uncertain moment, she kissed him back, clumsily and slow like a fawn on ice. Cody started to fall, literally this time, and caught himself. Their teeth clacked together.
"How?"
Megan deadpan against his lips, and they both broke into hysterical giggles. She was beautiful, but she'd never been as beautiful as she was then. Face red, eyes misty, lips a raw shade of kiss-scrubbed pink. Cody started to say, "I love you," but cut himself off at the last moment. Maybe it was a little too early for that. Megan brushed her hair behind her ear and looked coyly away, a big, happy smile cresting across her face. Cody admired it for a moment before speaking.
"I really like you," he said. As more than a friend."
"I like you too,"
she said, then added,
"the same way."
Now it was Cody's turn to smile. He slipped his fingers through hers, and she looked at him, her big blue eyes shimmering cobalt in the meager sun. For a long time, they simply held hands and talked. The air between them was different now, lighter, warmer. And as they walked home, Cody wasn't sure his feet touched the ground. He'd never been this happy before. He felt like he was going to float away and never, ever come down. At Megan's front gate, he took both of her hands in his, and she looked up at him with a loving twinkle.
"I wish I didn't have to go."
"I wish you didn't have to go either." She drew a deep, contented breath through her nose.
"I'll see you tomorrow."
"You will," he vowed. They lingered for a moment, then pulled apart.
"Bye,"
she said. "Bye." When she was gone, Cody sighed and started for home. It might be too early to say it, but it wasn't too early to feel it. He loved Megan Harriman with all his heart. Late afternoon, Bill Harper drove out of Joey Vandermeer's in a state of high anxiety. In the rearview mirror, his face was gray and stony, eyes staring, lips sour. He held the wheel in a white-knuckled death grip and thrummed with nervous energy like a high-tension wire. He was so deep in brooding that he sailed right past the gate and had to pull an illegal U-turn. At the top of the drive, he parked next to the stairs and got out, his Stetson casting his face in shadows. His features, normally doughy from age and the unpracticed sedation of a small-town cop, seemed sharper, harder, his stride longer. He climbed the stairs, grasped the brass knocker, and slammed it against the plate. Up here, staggered high above the valley floor, the only sounds were crows ducking and wheeling overhead, and the chilly October breeze roaring through the distant trees, defining Vandermeer Estate's back lot. Bill had always felt a certain tranquility up here, even if he didn't want to. But today, he felt only disquiet. When no one answered, he stabbed the doorbell. It pealed through the house, muffled like a funeral knell, and Bill impatiently tapped his foot. Just as he was about to knock again, the knob shook, and Joey Vandermeer's face appeared in the gap, eyes bleary and hair sticking out. "Oh,
Did I wake you, Your Highness?
What?
Joey asked, voice thick with sleep. We need to talk, Bill said. Sighing, Joey opened the door and stepped aside. He wore a blue robe with his family's crest over the left breast. Bill went in and Joey shut the door behind him.
Where's your maid?
Bill asked wryly.
Vacation,
Joey said.
You're alone?
For once. Bill hummed judgmentally. In the parlor, Joey sank onto the sofa, but Bill remained standing, too restless to sit.
Frank Stone's missing, he said, without preamble.
Joey's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
What?
He didn't come into work this morning, and I went out to his house. No one's there. I called the hospital. Everyone. Nobody knows where he is.
Joey rubbed his temple.
I know you heard about Andy.
Yes, I heard about Andy.
Pretty coincidental, isn't it? First Andy, then Marianne, now Frank.
For a second, Joey regarded him with a blank stare. Then his face darkened.
What are you saying?
He asked, a defensive edge in his voice.
I know you killed Marianne Preston, Bill charged. And now...
I didn't do shit.
Frank and Andy are gone.
Joey's jaw clenched, and the mist in his eyes cleared. Nothing wakes a man up quite like being accused of a triple murder.
I didn't do anything to Frank and Andy, he said tightly.
What the hell happened to him then?
Fuck if I know,
Joey spat.
You told me I'll handle it. Stay out of my way.
Flashing, Joey got to his feet.
I meant...
He stopped himself before he could say Marianne.
I don't care about her,
Bill said.
I care that we're all going missing. Andy, I thought he'd done left on his own, but now Frank, too. Who's next? Dave? Me?
Bill's voice shook and his chest heaved. He looked like a man one stiff breeze away from a catastrophic meltdown. Joey opened his mouth, then closed it again, as though that thought... that the men who killed Alyssa Preston were being targeted by someone that never occurred to him. He ran his fingers through his hair and started to pace.
You're sure Frank's gone? He asked.
Like I said, he didn't come in, and he wasn't at home.
Is it just today he didn't come in?
Yeah, Bill said. He was in on Friday.
At the mantel, Joey put his hands on his hips and stared thoughtfully up at the portrait of Louis Vandermeer.
That doesn't mean anything.
I think it does, Bill said coldly.
Out of all their friends, Frank had always been the most reasonable. As a kid, he was the impressionable kind who followed the crowd, but on his own, he didn't get in trouble, made good grades, and always did what he was supposed to do when he was supposed to. Andy was the kid to break and run when the pressure was on, but Frank wasn't. Joey knew that as well as anyone.
What about Andy?
He asked. Did you find anything?
Just his car,
Bill said. He started to add something else, but stopped himself. He wasn't sure whether or not he wanted to bring up Megan Harriman's dream or not, but decided to hold off for now. If he did, he'd all but be signing his death warrant, and even though she was a thorn in his side, he couldn't sanction the killing of a little girl. Not yet.
I didn't do it,
Joey said.
Okay, but yeah. It does look a little strange. Where's Dave?
On the road,
Bill said.
I talked to him before I came over here.
Joey nodded.
All right. If someone's doing something, who?
Your guess is as good as mine,
Bill said.
Someone who knows.
Joey sat on the edge of the sofa and chewed his thumbnail. From the look of worry in his eyes, he was being honest. He didn't do anything to Frank or Andy.
Who? That Harriman bitch?
Bill snorted.
You think a 100-pound little girl can get the drop on two grown men and make them completely disappear?
Who else could it be?
Joey asked, throwing his hands strickenly up.
Bobby?
Bill missed a beat.
I bet you that's exactly who it is, Joey said. You know how he's been about all of this. He's a bigger goddamn coward than you are. He's trying to eliminate everyone who knows he was involved.
Bill tried to picture Bobby killing someone and couldn't. He said as much, and Joey waved him dismissively off.
I guarantee it's him.
Joey steepled his fingers and tapped the tip of his nose. We watch our asses, and if we see him... Just before dusk, Cody slung his backpack over his shoulder and poked his head into the hall. Save for the drone of David Muir on ABC World News Tonight, the house was silent. He slipped out, pulled the door softly shut behind him, and tiptoed to the living room. Mom lay on the couch, curled up and asleep, a pill bottle open on the coffee table beside her coffee. Cody waited a minute to see if she would stir, then moved into the kitchen, wincing when the floor creaked underneath him. Mom didn't wake from her drug-induced sleep, and emboldened, Cody hurried to the back door and outside. Crimson light bathed the world, and the laughter of playing children infused the cool breeze. He paused one last time, saving for the mother, who wouldn't stir, and likely wouldn't care if she did, then crossed the driveway and hung a left. He wasn't going to meet his father tonight. He was just going to... what? Observe. Observe what? He couldn't say. His plan wasn't very well laid out, but he had to do something. It made him feel weak and dumb to be this way. But he really, really wanted to know his dad. On the main street, he followed the sidewalk across the bridge. The terrain began rugged outside of town, and the road's gravel shoulder narrowed. There were a number of walking trails and dirt bike paths crisscrossing the countryside, and he left the highway in favor of those. The sun gradually melted in the western sky, its fiery color bleeding across the horizon. The first stars of night appeared in the east, glinting in the purplish heavens like winking eyes encouraging his quest. He climbed a brief hill, hunched forward like a mountaineer on a history-making hike, and when he reached the top, he was winded and covered in sweat. Several times along the way, he unconsciously ran his tongue over his lower lip to catch the last lingering taste of Megan's kiss. Giddy happiness fizzed in his chest, and he let out a sigh. Could life be any more perfect right now? Andy was gone, hopefully dead. Megan was his girlfriend, and he was taking the first steps to know his real father. Nope, he didn't think it could. For a time, he followed a barren ridgeline commanding a sweeping view of the valley, then came to a stand of pine trees. The land sloped gently down until it evened out, and the trees pressed closer together. Dense gloom pooled in the forest, and fireflies danced between gnarled trunks like flurries of irritated snow. Cody paused, unshouldered his backpack, and dug his flashlight out. He didn't click it on, though. The highway was less than 200 feet to his left, and he didn't want to draw unnecessary attention to himself. A half mile on, the trail came to a rutted dirt road and petered out. The sky was a deep shade of blue, and twilight filled the land. To his right, the road crossed on for maybe a quarter mile before curving out of sight. On the left, it angled up and met the highway, its head partially hidden behind a screen of hanging branches. A pair of headlights zipped by, heading in the direction of the interstate, and Cody instinctively ducked. He checked Google Maps, confirms that he was on the right track, and went on. It was full dark when blazing lights came into view through the trees on his left. Drifts of dead leaves papered the ground, and a half-moon lifted above the rim of the earth like the mad grin of a pagan god. Cody leaned against a tree and craned his neck, hoping to get a better look at what lay beyond the glow. He didn't. Hunching his shoulders, he moved as quietly as the leaves would allow and stopped at another tree. This one with a rusted, no trespassing sign nailed into the bark. He could just make out the shape of the house. Staring at it, so close to knowing his real father, Cody's throat went dry and his heartbeat accelerated. He went to take a step, but his mother's words came back to him. Don't tell anyone, especially him. Rarely had he ever seen her so sober, severe, and it gave him pause. She was just mad at Dad over something. Maybe he broke up with her and wouldn't pay child support or something. If he went up to the back door and knocked, Dad would be happy to see him and invite him in, wouldn't he? Or would it be Andy all over again? That thought chilled him.
All he wanted was a dad. A real dad. One that didn't sneer at him like he was slime, or call him names, or lose his patience after 2 seconds. One that would give him advice and play catch with him, and do all that other stuff dads are supposed to do. Instead, he'd probably wind up with someone else to hate his guts just for being born. The longing in his chest flickered like a small, wind-harangued spark, and he vacillated. Maybe he should just go home and forget about it. He didn't really even need a dad anymore. He wanted to be close to his, Andy, for a long time. But now he had Megan, and she made him so incredibly happy he could scarcely contain it. What could Dad possibly add to that? A lot. Making up his mind, he pushed away from the tree and crept into the backyard. He'd knock and go from there. Or maybe he'd only look through the window. He wasn't entirely sure yet. He'd decide once he got there. Past the tree line, the grass was lush and green, neatly raked and free of debris, as though leaves simply evaporated as soon as they landed here, like flakes of snow on too warm ground. He darted to an outbuilding, moved along the wall, and came to the opposite corner. Pressing his body to splintered wood, he poked his head out. The back steps, pragmatic and unadorned concrete leading up to the door, were roughly 75 feet off. A window flanked them to one side, and if he stood on his tippy toes, he could lift above the sill, just high enough to see inside. He slid around the corner and approached the house, but froze when a twig snapped behind him. He started to turn, and someone snatched the back of his neck, wrenching him back and off his feet. A shocked gasp exploded from him, and before he could scream, his attacker spun him around and slammed him hard against the side of the shed. Hot, red agony spider-veined through his skull, and a moan disgorged from his lips. Without warning, large, calloused hands closed around his throat and bore down with crushing strength. Cody's eyes bulged from their sockets, and barbed, bursting panic welled in his chest, mindless with fear. Cody flailed his arms and legs like a drowning boy. The adversary, cloaked in shadows, redoubled his grip, and Cody's face began to tingle. He was going to die. The revelation sent a shockwave through Cody's body. He gave a frantic, body-wide thrash in futile effort to break loose. His nails tore at the backs of the killer's hands, and his feet pummeled his knees, but his assault did no good. Warm wool tingled the edges of his consciousness, and his lungs burned for the slightest taste of cool, life-giving oxygen. He scratched harder, faster, his panic metastasizing into hysteria. His head swam, his face throbbed. He sucked for air, pulled a nun in, and sucked deeper. In the shadows, his assailant panted like a predator, working itself into a blood-hungry frenzy. Silvery moonlight reveled only his outline, blurring as tears filled Cody's eyes. Cody tried to beg, to plead, but only a series of strangled gurgles came out. He was sinking, sinking, the void of death rising around him like black water, dragging him down into the depths. Giving in, he started to cry. He didn't want to die. He just wanted his dad. In the last seconds of Cody's life, his bladder released, and warm liquid spread across the crotch of his pants. He was numb now, and barely felt it, barely even registered the humiliation. He just hoped Megan didn't find out he pissed himself. She might. Might.
Brody, you're making me nervous.
The dog, pacing back and forth in front of the closet, spared his master a quick, uninterested glance, as though she were but a gnat buzzing in his ear. Well then, Megan thought, with a faux indignity that was supposed to lighten the mood, but didn't. She was sitting barefoot and cross-legged in bed, books, loose papers, and scribbled notes fanned out before her. The room was dark, save for the sphere of baited light cast by the lamp, and silent, too. She was listening to music on her phone, but it died, and she was too lazy to get up and plug it in. She favored the door with the way one might a vicious animal temporarily subdued, then flicked her eyes to her book with a sigh. It could have been her imagination, but she could feel Alyssa's presence all around like static energy. If she squinted hard enough, she might even be able to see her. Picking up her pencil, she slipped a sheet of paper out from beneath the text and consulted the page to make sure she did the equations right. Whoops. Bungled this one. How did she manage to place the decibel? Something clamped down on her throat, and the breath left her lungs in a sudden rush, as though sucked out with a hose. Her heart did a backward somersault, and her eyes widened in alarm, her hands flying instinctively to her neck, a steely band pulled tight across her windpipe, and the fringes of her vision strained white. She threw her head back and gulped like a fish flopping on a dock, but her airways were blocked. What was happening? Birdie turned, saw her distressed, and jerked. A scream, high and mournful, rang in her ears, and animal panic clawed at her chest. Someone was choking her, but no one was there. Birdie let out a sharp bark, and Megan rocked forward on her knees, her fingers digging into the soft flesh of her neck as if to dislodge the invisible hands throttling her. She distinctly felt the thumb pressing against her trachea, pushing into it, snapping it, bone splinters drawing into her convulsing lungs. Birdie barked again, the sound echoing as unconsciousness stole over Megan's brain. Dying. She was dying. The scream came again, louder this time, and the world abruptly changed. She was no longer inside her warmly lit bedroom. She was outside in the nighttime chill. A hulking, formless mass, black as the sky above, held her off the ground, back pinned against splintery wood. Her legs kicked, the arms waved, fluid sluiced down the insides of her thigh. She was not in control, merely watching, feeling. She was crying unashamedly, gripped by the pitiful terror of a small child alone and afraid in its hour of dying. A strand of moonlight fell across her murderer's face, and in it she beheld the mad, fixed stare of a monster penetrating her soul, violating her heart. In a flash, she was lying supine on her bedroom floor, Brody desperately licking her face. The hands relented. And she sucked a great, heaving breath. Something was wrong. Really wrong. Jamming her elbows into the floor, she pushed herself up, and vertigo overcame her. She started to fall, but caught herself on the nightstand. Brody circled her excitedly, and she unthinkingly pushed him away. She got to her knees, slapped her hands on the edge of the bed for support, and drew up on her knees. Her chest ached, her head hurt, and the keen, stabbing panic lingered in her stomach, like seeping wounds from a blade. She swallowed and winced. Her throat was sore, her larynx pulsing like a cartoon character's finger after a swift hit from a hammer. Brody growled, and she turns to the closet. Brilliant white light shone under the door.